We've been talking a lot about particle detectors, and we've been talking about the relativistic nature of quantum field theory and how coupling particle detectors is okay with that, and I've been giving you arguments on how the from first principles those couplings work and come from and so on, and we compare with quantum optics, but we haven't really, so if we're really truly doing anything relativistic here, there's questions that come to mind, right? Because I've always was writing T and X, which are a particular set of coordinates, and I was not considering at all that the detector may have a state of motion that could be different from the frame in which I did the canonical quantization of the field. In other words, the frame that I chose, the coordinates I chose to solve the wave equation or the field equations and get a basis of solutions, and I was writing the same T and X and so on and not caring much about it. That is what is used. This is universal everywhere in quantum optics. No one cares much about different states of motion. It's about time we care about it. It is very important for the topic at hand in relativistic quantum information. So a little bit of an introductory note quickly. This is classical mechanics. This is something that you've seen. It's actually a canonical transformation of a Hamiltonian in classical mechanics, but let's discuss it a little bit though, just in case. So imagine that I have a Hamiltonian, H of t, and of course, usually in quantum, in quantum mechanics, obviously, people don't care much about talking what this Hamiltonian is, right? Because it's like, well, yeah, Hamiltonian is, people even say it's the energy, but the Hamiltonian is the generator of time translations. And as such, is generating translations. When you exponentiate that, it's generating translations with respect to a time coordinate. One time coordinate, not different time coordinates. One time parameter, right? So what happens if I reparameterize, forget relativity or anything, this is just a problem. I have a Hamiltonian that generates translations with respect to time t. This is what I notate with this little t in here, as a function of t, and say that I reparameterize time. I use a different clock or whatever, and I reparameterize time to a time tau, so that t is a function of tau, okay? Now my question is, how does the Hamiltonian change? Perhaps the first idea some people may have, well, I don't know, you may know the answer, obviously, because you know mechanics, but the first idea someone may have is, oh, just take the Hamiltonian, usually people don't write these t's in here, right, on the left, take this Hamiltonian and substitute t by the function of tau, and that's it, right? That's kind of a first naive approach, if you want. Well, what is this object, I wonder? So is this what we want to do? So this is not quite what we want to do, right? This Hamiltonian is still the Hamiltonian that generates translations with respect to t, only that I wrote it as a function of tau. But that's not what we want. If I'm telling you how does the Hamiltonian behave under time reparametrizations, what I'm asking you is that what is the Hamiltonian, though, if I know the Hamiltonian that generates translation with respect to t is this, what is the Hamiltonian that generates translations with respect to tau, which is different from this? This thing is ht t of tau is, again, the Hamiltonian that generates translations with respect to t. Of course, if you write it explicitly as a function of tau, Right, so we can do a very quick, I mean, it's kind of trivial to see what the Hamiltonian that generates translation with respect to tau would be, but let's illustrate it with a very simple quantum mechanics. I mean, this is classical, 100%. It's again a canonical reparametrization of time in classical mechanics, but let's just do an example with, sorry, that's like too loud. Do an example with just quick way of seeing it. If you write Schrödinger equation, right? Let's say you write d dt psi equals h t of t psi, like that, and say that I reparameterize time, and I change t by a function t of tau, a time reparametrization. So under time reparametrizations, this becomes dt d tau dt with the I, of course, dd tau psi equals to h t t of tau psi, right? So important fact, you have to apply chain rule to refer derivatives now to derivatives with respect to tau, not with respect to t. And of course, that means that I can rewrite this as I d d tau psi equals dt d tau h t t of tau. And then we look at that and we say, oh, this is a Schrödinger equation now in the parameter tau, and the Hamiltonian, oh, sorry. And what plays the role of the Hamiltonian here is not h t t tau, is this whole thing. This is, right, if we write the Schrödinger equation in the new parameter, right, what we get is that we have an h of tau now, or generating tau, t of tau. Right? So this, the Hamiltonian h of tau that generates translations with respect to tau, the new time parameter, it's equal to the redshift factor dt d tau Hamiltonian that generates with respect to t, t of tau. All right? I used Schrödinger equation. I could have used whatever. Like, this is a classical mechanics thing. Okay? So the Hamiltonian does not transform like a scalar, if you want, under time reparametrizations. Okay? Not surprisingly, this thing is the generator of translations with respect to time. So of course, there's a redshift factor in it. And this is not relativity or anything. Again, this is classical mechanics, Hamiltonians under time reparametrizations. Something that you probably knew, but it's good to have in mind when we do this. Any questions? All right. So obviously, time evolution in quantum mechanics is invariant under time reparametrizations. So if you have time evolution, which is, again, I'm still talking about the quantum version of a classical thing. This thing, h t or h tau, are the generators of translations with respect to time. The u, the time evolution, is the exponential map that gives you the transformation, the time evolution, the translation with respect to time. So time evolution is invariant under time reparametrization. Very easy to see, right? U, the time evolution operator, so the time ordered exponential of minus I h bar, oh, without h bar, let's just not write the h bar, minus I integral on the whole real line d tau h tau tau is of course equal to the time order exponential of minus e, minus I, r, d tau, then dt, d tau, h, t, of t of tau. All that I did is substitute the Hamiltonian. And then, of course, this is equal to the time order exponential of minus I, integral of dt on the whole real line, h t of tau, of t, sorry. Right? So the time evolution operator is, of course, invariant under time reparametrization. This thing connects to Cauchy surfaces. It connects the minus infinity to infinity in time, connects the distant past with the distant future. And what reparametrizations I do with my Hamiltonian, this thing doesn't care. All right? This is changing the parameter of the trajectory you're describing. Okay? Any questions? All right. Okay, so now that that's discussed, let's consider what we are doing when we have a detector coupled to a field. Now, when we have a detector coupled to a field, we have I mean, in quantum optics, people say, oh, here's how would you do it, right? Oh, this is interesting, though. I give you three ingredients. So let's make a line here to separate this introductory side note from the following. I give you, and this is something that you would do in quantum optics, superconducting circuits, in an NMR lab, every time that you're given like elemental systems that you understand very well independently, and then someone tells you, and they interact like this, write the Hamiltonian, right? There's a lot of non-innocent steps coming in here. So I say, oh, atoms or detectors. Let's call it detectors for now. Detectors. Oh, yeah, I know the free Hamiltonian. Free Hamiltonian. Is h of t, or let's call it tau, why not? H of tau is equal to, right, the energy gap of the detector, sigma plus, sigma minus. Which means, right, two levels, the ground state has energy zero, it's an eigenstate of that with eigenvalue zero. The excited state is an eigenstate with eigenvalue omega. So this is indeed the usual thing, ground excited with an energy gap omega. Right? People give you that. And then they say, oh yeah, fields. Let's say the simplest, a free scalar field has what we call a free Hamiltonian. And let's write a very simple form. Let's say integral over k. N is the dimensions of the space-time that you have, the dimension of space. I'm going to use n as spatial dimensions, by the way. N is better. K and then omega k a dagger k a k, which is, well, I mean, this is subtracting any zero-point energy that there might be in the field. That's what you get. Cool, this is the free Hamiltonian. Let's call it 0d for detector and 0 phi for field, okay? And then they tell you, oh, the coupling, I know, they couple, right? And they couple, and I know the interaction Hamiltonian from first principles is, they say, a dipole coupling, or in the case of a scalar one, a monopole coupling. So if it's a monopole coupling, you say interaction Hamiltonian is, let's say, I don't know what to even write here, maybe T. Well, interaction Hamiltonian goes like, what you know for first principles is, goes like monopole times field, right? That's what we kind of discussed that. Or dipole times vector field, right? And then usually that's the thing. So usually you're given like NMR, oh, we have a system one, a system two, and we make them interact, and interaction is like this, and then you write the Hamiltonian. Or you have, this would be quantum optics if you want, you have the system and the field, and they interact. So usually what people do when relativity is not a thing that they care about, they just, all right, the total Hamiltonian is the sum of the three. Agreed, people? And that's the simple way in which you build full Hamiltonians, knowing the interaction from first principles and the two free Hamiltonians, right? Anyone sees any problem with this? I know you do. Anyone else? Tell me, what's the problem?
They're not generating time translations with respect to the same.
They may not be generating time translation with respect to the same times. Because who prescribes, so here's the point. In what reference frame does this Hamiltonian has this form? As we discussed, Hamiltonians are not innocent objects when we reparametrize time. So, The free Hamiltonian of the atom, right, it makes sense that this prescribed in the frame of the atom. When you go and write the Hamiltonian, test it against experiment, what you do first is you put your lab co-moving with the atom and then make the experiment there. You're talking about an atom is here, center of mass of the atom, and the atom gets transitions and I'm co-moving with that and I'm describing them with respect to the origin at the center of mass of the atom, right? So this thing generates translations with respect to time tau, where tau, say, is the detector's proper time. And again, the detector's proper time means the center of mass of the detector's proper time, because detectors can be extended objects that we will discuss hopefully today as well. Atoms are extended objects. All right, so what about the field? Now, if I write the field like that, everyone knows what kind of T I'm translating with respect to with this Hamiltonian. Is it, when I write the field like that, am I writing this Hamiltonian with respect to observers that are accelerating? No. I'm writing this Hamiltonian with respect to an inertial reference frame. It so happens the field Hamiltonians are Lorentz invariant. So any, pick any Lorentzian inertial reference frame, this thing generates translation with respect to, let's call the quantization frame, which is a arbitrary inertial reference frame in which I decided to solve, in the case of a scalar field, the wave equation, or the Klein-Gordon equation if there's a mass. All right? So this thing, T, is the quantization frame time, or as we can call it, the lap time. How about that? We call it lap time. Okay? We're not gonna, if we build in a quantum field theory, what we're gonna pick is an inertial frame commoving with my lap. As you can tell, the free Hamiltonian of the atom and the free Hamiltonian of the field generate translations with respect to different times. So if you want to write the full system free Hamiltonian, it would be a big mistake to just naively say, oh, is this plus this? Because you are summing up two things that generate translation with respect to different times. That is not correct. That's what we do in quantum mechanics usually, because in quantum mechanics, remember, time is just a parameter that is the same for everyone in most cases. But if you're doing quantum field theory or you care about relativity, you cannot do that. And now another question then. Okay, fine, you told me yesterday from first principles that the Hamiltonian is something like, let's just write it. The Hamiltonian is, oh, I'm gonna write a T, for example, but we have to decide, we haven't decided anything, because who prescribes the interaction Hamiltonian? What frame what time does it generate translation with respect to? We need to discuss a bit. But let's just write it as I told you. So there was some coupling strength. There was some switching function. That I'm not gonna write any arguments or anything, but we can write whatever argument we want, to be honest. And then we have, let's write the point-like version, to make it simple. So you have something here, monopole moment, and then the field, okay? And now the question is, who prescribes the Hamiltonian? In the derivation we saw yesterday, both the atom and the field were, the atom was commoving with the quantization frame, if you remember, which is in the same coordinates as the field. So let's discuss, people, who prescribes the interaction Hamiltonian? So when it's given like this, with respect to what time does the interaction Hamiltonian like that generate translations to? I want to hear opinions, if any. No opinions, yeah.
I think we're interested in measuring the detector, so we should move all coordinates into that frame.
That is true, but that doesn't respond, that doesn't answer the question. I need to know which one has this form in order to move all of them to the same, and then it's arbitrary. You can do the lab frame or you can do the detector frame, and I will agree with you that the best way to do it is moving everything to the detector's frame. That's great when you have only one detector. What if you have two detectors with different states of motion? Then maybe the lab frame is the best. I don't know. Okay, but yeah, this is something to discuss. But first, we need to determine what is the natural prescription. If someone tells you in your NMR lab or something, someone tells you, oh, here's the interaction Hamiltonian. And then you would not think of asking, oh, with respect to what time does it generate translation? Because your systems are all like commoving or very almost the same commoving, right? And then you would not care about that. But if the systems were relativistic, you have a system in a state of motion, and then an interaction Hamiltonian that someone tells you goes like this. Then you need to ask, oh, hold on, with respect to what time does it generate translations? So the interaction Hamiltonian here is referred, when it's for first principles derived, to the center of mass of the atom. The atom is a field. The atom is not moving in the description for first principles that I gave you. The Hamiltonian as prescribed, generates translations with respect to tau. And then you can write a tau here or a t, I don't care. Whoever prescribes the switching, I don't care. But the translations that this interaction fundamentally prescribes, this is the proper time of the atom. And of course, here, you're gonna have, if it's a point like one, it's gonna be like this, but I'm gonna get better. Don't copy this right away. So a point-like detector will see the field along the trajectory of such point-like detector. Basically, it's not seeing the field, it's seeing the field pulled back to the trajectory of the detector. Okay? That's what the atom sees. So this thing generates translation with respect to tau. So when we write the full Hamiltonian, we need to transform either the free Hamiltonian of the atom or the interaction Hamiltonian to the Laff frame, and by that I mean generating translation with respect to the Laff frame and not this one, or transform the field one to the Laff frame, or to the detector's frame. All right, that's something to be careful about. All right, any questions? Yes?
So, like, we have to work really hard to make this all work.
Did we?
This formalism, which is just because Hamiltonians are not Lorentz invariant, why don't we just use the path integral?
Oh, why didn't we? Good question. This is the actually, if you want to compute things with particle detectors, doing path integrals is less convenient for most cases. We're going to talk a little bit about it because we're going to talk. It depends on what you want to compute. That's the point. There are some times that path integrals are great. There are some times that are not. When we talk a little bit about thermality, now if you want to see things about like vacuum transition and so on, you're free to choose. You can do path integral. But if you are working with thermal states, sometimes path integrals are complicated because the partition function, as you probably know, for infinite dimensional quantum systems is tricky, as in like not defined. So yeah, sir, the question is valid, and yeah, you can do path integral. It becomes more complicated than this formalism. This is, we're working a lot to build it so that we don't have to care anymore about it when we know it's built properly. And once it's built properly, it's very computational, let's say, and mechanical. Not saying that path integral is not useful when you have detectors. It is, and in some cases, it's much better than this. But again, finding a Hamiltonian description of the interaction of a detector and a field has many advantages computationally, also many advantages because this is what quantum optics does. So if you want to tell people, oh, look, in this particular phenomenon, you are forgetting some relativistic aspects of it, you better write it like this to compare with what they've done. Many reasons, but again, valid, very valid question. You could do path integral. With path integral, you have the problem that your field representing the atom is not a covariant thing. So you have to be careful. You see, you have two fields if you want, a monopole density and a scalar field, and they're interacting. And then you can treat it literally like a path integral formalism with two fields. Only one of them is not a covariant, Lorentz covariant kind of field. So there are complications with that, but can be done. Eh? And those things are done. And you can derive Feynman diagrams, and you can do all the things that you usually do. But keep in mind that path integrals are usually most useful when you have kind of long-time computations of the S matrix kind of type. Here we're going to do finite-time computations. So path integral becomes a tad more difficult as well. But very nice, and I like that comment a lot. More questions? All right. So that considered, now let's write the good way of writing this, the Hamiltonian, and how, let's discuss how it transforms under changes of reference frame, or in general changes of coordinates. Say that we have now a detector that can go in arbitrary motion, right? So you have a detector. We have a finite size, so not necessarily point-like, detector whose center of mass moves with a trajectory in the Laff frame given by x is some function of, well, x of t. All right? So we have a detector that moves with a trajectory x of t. And then, of course, we have two frames here. Let's call t psi the proper frame of the detector. And let's call Tx the Laff frame, which is going to be an inertial frame where we do the field quantization. And by that, remember what I mean. When I say that's the quantization frame, I mean that's the frame we choose to express the solutions of whatever dynamical equations of the field you're considering. A massless scalar, well, that would be wave equation. All right. So two frames. And this frame of the detector is not an inertial frame. The detector can move in arbitrary trajectories, obviously. Now, here's a problem. A detector is an extended object, right? Like an atom. It doesn't live in a point. It's not a point-like thing. It has shape. It lives in an extended region of space. Now, if we accelerate a detector, we need to make an assumption. If you remember your tutorial one, right? You did a problem or GR courses, whatever you've done, whatever version of this you've done this problem, or not at all. So if you get an extended object and you accelerate it, right? All the points in the extended object cannot accelerate with the same acceleration. It will break. Agreed? So we need to make an assumption of rigidity. And the assumption we make for the detector, it's called the Fermi-Walker rigidity. So what does that mean? Fermi-Walker rigidity says in the proper frame of the center of mass of the detector, the distance of the center of mass to all the points of the detector remains the same. That's the assumption. The distance between the origin of the reference frame of the detector, so the center position, this is the position of the center of mass of the detector, and all points of the detector remains constant in the tau xi frame. Now, how physical is that assumption? So you see, it's rigid. When you declare an object is rigid, in relativity, it's often said that rigid objects don't exist in relativity. That's not quite true, as you know from the tutorial. What it means is that rigidity is a frame-dependent statement. You can be rigid in one frame, but not in others, in that sense. Okay? Anyway, so the Fermi-Walker rigidity here, it's called Fermi-Walker because Fermi-Walker frames, right? The co-moving frame at every point in the center of mass of a set of points and so on. My question is how physical this is. Is it physical? Is it non-physical? Yep.
To a certain amount of stress placed on an object, you kind of expect the internal forces to hold it together.
Precisely. So the reason it's physical is because, well, an atom or any other object, when you can definitely accelerate your hand, and your hand is kind of rigid in the center of mass of the hand reference frame. The reason is that, well, sir, you are imparting forces to every point in the... Remember that every point in the atom here has to accelerate with a different proper acceleration in order to keep rigidity. So if they accelerate with different accelerations, they're going to be tensions, like the two rockets kind of tensions. But those tensions can be compensated by internal coherent forces, consistent forces. For example, the electromagnetic interaction that keeps the electron tied to the proton. You can estimate, there are papers that have estimated experimentally how much you can accelerate if you're careful with it, how much you can accelerate the center of mass of an atom without destroying it, without altering its rigidity. And accelerations are brutal. It's the order of, I have here the number, you can get of the order of, just a second. Or the order of 10 to the 7, even larger than 10 to the 17 G. You have to be really careful with that, but that's, you may not break an atom if you still accelerate an acceleration of 10 to the 17 G. This is theory. This is basically using laser techniques to accelerate the center of mass, so pushing with light the atom, being really careful not to excite the atom, being very orthogonal to the internal structure, and they get a theoretical limit that is around and above 10 to the 17 g for atoms, for a hydrogen-like atom. In the lab, people have done, not with atoms, but with electrons, people have done more than that. With electrons, you can accelerate easily 10 to the 25 g, and no problem. But then again, that's an assumption to keep in mind. When we talk about a detector, the detector can move arbitrarily. If we are just describing what is the measurement on the field that we do, we don't care, because you can use a detector for two reasons, right? You can use it to actually make measurements on the field in a theoretical kind of sense, as a measurement theory, if you want, to replace projections. And then you don't care. You just move it around, and you have Fermi-Walker rigidity, and those are just assumptions to measure the observables you want to measure. Or you can think of it as a really physical system, an atom that couples to the field. But in that case, you have to be careful because this assumption may break eventually, depending on how violent your trajectory is. All right? OK. So that said, my question is, so let's write the interaction Hamiltonian. Luckily, going to the interaction picture, Schrödinger picture, and so on, it's easy, because going from interaction picture to Schrödinger picture is through exponentials of the free Hamiltonians integrated in time. And because of that, we know that the U's, the exponential maps generated by the Hamiltonians, are invariant under time reparametrization. And those things are not dependent on the coordinates. So we are fine. The question is, now, what does the interaction Hamiltonian look like from different frames? And first of all, what does the interaction Hamiltonian look like from the atoms frame, which is the one you prescribed it? So you see, you can prescribe it from first principle in one frame, but you're not free to prescribe it in any other frame. Once you have prescribed in one frame, you need to transform it to see what it looks like in different frames. And those of you who have done ADM formalism of GR know that finding Hamiltonians and finding Hamiltonians and changing from one coordinate to another set of coordinates is tough in general. Okay, so here's a simpler, because we haven't gotten general relativity yet, and this is the trajectories of detectors. So here's like the magic of pullbacks, which makes things much simpler. But still, it's non-trivial. It's not naive, let's say. Let's see. So say that I write my interaction Hamiltonian based on the first principle, so I know. So the interaction Hamiltonian will generate translation with respect to tau. And this interaction Hamiltonian in the interaction picture would be some coupling strength, then some switching function, say, prescribed by the atom. That doesn't matter. Like, the switcher could be the lab or the atom. I don't care about that. It could be a tau, or it could be a T of tau, whatever you prefer. Okay. And then you get the integral is mirror in space. Of course, we are describing it in the atoms frame, where it's rigid, where you can talk about a smearing function. So let's describe it in the atoms frame. So this is an integral on the spatial coordinate of a smearing function that is given, of course, in the atomic frame. All right. And then, yes, we have the monopole moment of the atom. Keep in mind, this is the monopole density that we call m before. So if you want to call it m hat, that would be an m of tau xi. OK? And this couples to the field. Now, the field, I'm not going to quantize the field in the tau xi frame. That would be stupid. The reason is that that frame is not inertial in general. If you want to go to quantization in non-inertial frames, first of all, it's not enough with one in general. And second of all, it's going to make your life much tougher. So what you do is, yeah, sure, this thing is the field quantized in the usual frame. But then, of course, you need to, luckily, it's a scalar field, so no transformations in here. So T is a T of tau and xi. And of course, x is also an x of tau and psi. So this is the version of this, right? The mere version of this. Here I told you that the detector sees the field only pulled back to its trajectory, which makes sense. The detector only sees the field at the points the detector is, and on the trajectory. Here's the same, only integrated to all the points the detector is. Keep in mind, this is still the trajectory of the detector. The detector in the center of mass frame, the trajectory is just I'm at zero all the time. And then I'm smeared, OK? So this is the detector seeing the field only along its trajectory. Yes?
Is the integration over the volume of the detector?
Yes. Let me write an n. This is the smearing function of the detector. And this is an integral, spatial integral. Let me just move. That means n is spatial dimensions.
Like, is the bound of the spatial integration just
the smearing function will tell you. The duration of the interaction, the switching function will tell you. How big the atom is, the detector is, the smearing function will tell you. All right? Yes, so of course, if it's compactly supported, you can restrict this domain Rn. You can restrict this domain to just the volume of the detector. Yes?
When you say pullback, is there a formal definition of that?
Or yes, there is. No, no. It's a formal definition. It's a bit of a math notion, but a pullback in general takes you from objects that live in a manifold, that is a global thing, to objects that live in the tangent space, that is a local thing. Kind of. So it's kind of the atom is seeing like an interaction with the field local at every point along the trajectory at every point of the trajectory of the field. All right. Questions so far? So my question now for you is, all right, so this is the Hamiltonian that generates translations with respect to the detector's proper time. What will be the Hamiltonian that generates translations with respect to the lab frame, the lab time, t? Okay. So, let's see. To see it is kind of nice. There are several ways to see it, but the way I prefer is kind of nice to see it by imposing, again, the same thing, that the time evolution operator should be invariant and the changes of reference frame. So if I have a Cauchy surface here, and a Cauchy surface here, so say that you have space-time, and you have broken space-time. By broken, I mean that I have infinity here and infinity there. And I have a Cauchy surface at minus infinity in time, and a Cauchy surface at plus infinity, the U that connects the two should be independent of the reference frame in which I decide to parameterize the interaction. Let's demand that and see how the Hamiltonian changes. So, for this, let me write first the Hamiltonian at tau as an integral over space of a Hamiltonian density with tau. Okay? So this h of tau, small h, is the density that when integrated over the volume of space gives you the Hamiltonian. Okay? All right. So of course that means, if you look at that Hamiltonian, that means that the density h tau of psi, these are operators, of course, it's equal to lambda chi of tau, mu of tau, f of chi, and then phi t of tau chi x of tau chi. All right. And that is nice because I know then that u tau, u, which is the time order exponential of the integral, or minus I integral, in the whole time domain, d tau of h of tau, right? This thing is also equal to the time order exponential of minus I. Now, integral over space-time. And the question may come again, why didn't you do then path integral from the beginning? Because what you're doing is covariantizing this. So that's already in the path integral. Yes, you could have done this for this. But I'm just being consistent with all that I'm doing. OK? So you have here d tau. You have here d xi, right? And then you have here a density tau. Nice. So you have a space-time integral in here. And that space-time integral, what you can do with it is to change coordinates. This thing has to be equal, remember. This thing has to be equal to the time order exponential. And this I'm imposing here, if you want. the time order exponential of minus I r dt integral d psi, sorry, dx of h with respect to t hat x. These two things have to be equal. Changing the reference frame should not change the time evolution connecting two Cauchy hypersurfaces. Nice. Then we know what the relationship is between the two. The relationship is a change of coordinates. Agreed? I'm changing the variables of integration from here to here. That's all that I'm doing. But that gives you the non-triviality. The non-triviality is that between the two, there is a Jacobian of difference. So the Jacobian of the coordinate transformation will show up in the Hamiltonian density from the left frame. So this is the Hamiltonian density. It's not a one, it's a hat. Hamiltonian density, Hamiltonian density in the lab frame. This is the Hamiltonian density in the detector's frame. OK. Nice. So let me just write directly what the result is, which is h t, or let me just write the capital H of t, which of course will be the integral over space x of the Hamiltonian density t x. Then it becomes the, let me write the lambda, the chi of tau, or if you want t of tau, you want to change it. That is up to you. And then you get the integral over space. And here's the thing that changes if you want. You have the smearing function, so you have the smearing function, well, the switching to begin with. Oh, I wrote the switching wrong. Sorry about that. Lambda integral space x r. And then you get the switching, of course. Now it's a tau, if you want, of tx. Of course, it's not a point-like thing or anything, huh? So the switching now is not quite a switching function. It's got a switching part and then parts as well that make space. So the switching factors in the smearing. How long the interaction plays a role on how big the detector is according to the field as seen from the lab. So if you want to talk about the size of an atom, the size of a detector, that's such an observer dependent in many ways. It's not just that you declare a physical size with the wave function or whatever. It's that if you measure the size with light, you measure the size with the field. And you measure the size with the field in the lab frame, then you're mixing the switching function, how long the interaction was on, factors into the shape and size of the detector. Such is relativity. OK, I'll answer, but let me just write the whole form. And then f is an f of xi, which is a function of t and x. Same thing, the smearing now factors in time. And then you have the mu that also mixes t and x. And then you have the field, much easier now, Tx. And also, don't forget that we have the Jacobian of the coordinate transformation. Right, and the coordinate transformation is not going to be a Lorentz transformation in general. If you remember, the Jacobian of a Lorentz transformation is 1. Is going to be a general coordinate transformation. So this Jacobian is non-trivial. This is, by the way, if you were to do general relativity, square root of the determinant of the metric that you get when you do a full covariant formalism from the beginning. All right, questions? You had one.
Is the fact that h has the same functional form with respect to x and psi due to this Fermi-Walker rigidity?
No, no. Look, from x, what is the shape of the detector? Well, it's funky. It's mixed. It's part of it is in the switching. Part of it is in the smearing. Part of it is in the monopole. So no, no, it doesn't have the same support in X as it has got in chi, if that's what you're excited.
We wrote, like, we went from little h of x to little h, or little h of Cassie to little h of x.
I changed coordinates here, right? So I have an integral here, and I changed the integration variables to a different frame. That's all I did. And I call this guy h of t. You see, if you are given a Hamiltonian density in the lab frame, this is how you compute the time evolution operator, right? Forget everything else. I give you a Hamiltonian density in the left frame, you say, oh yeah, the time evolution is this. And then I give you a Hamiltonian density in the detector's frame, and you say, okay, fine, the time evolution is this. And I'm saying they have to be equal because they connect the same Cauchy hypersurfaces.
I thought the reason we write this T and tau as little like superscripts rather than arguments was because they actually have different functional forms.
No, it's because they they do have different forms. Look, the Hamiltonian density here is not the same as this one. So forget the integral on space and you get the Hamiltonian density. They are different functional forms when you substitute everything in. But also that small t and the small tau represent the fact that they generate translations with respect to different time parameters. So the direction of propagation here for every point in one case is this, whereas in the other case it could be that, for example. And every point maps, huh? Still, but it's a different direction of propagation. Okay, I did inertial here, but doesn't have to be inertial. It will be funny at every point. All right, we can discuss more about that later, if not enough. The one thing I want to tell you before I leave is now a quick calculation that generalizes the calculation we did yesterday and allows us to discuss a little bit of characteristic of the field, how algebraic quantum field theory connects with this detector business. Anyway, let's just do one thing. Why don't we compute the transition probability transition probability from going from the ground to the excited state or from the excited to the ground. Remember, this is with positive omega. This is with negative omega, right? Reversing omega changes the calculation from an excitation probability to a de-excitation probability because swaps the two levels. All right? For an arbitrary state of the field that I call rho phi. And let's solve rho phi. So, okay, and point-like detectors. Arbitrary trajectory, though, okay? Right, so, of course, the initial state, if I want to write the initial state of the whole system, this is you start from the ground for the detector and then an arbitrary state of the field, completely uncorrelated. And then we write the Hamiltonian. So the Hamiltonian here, H, of course, with respect to tau, interaction Hamiltonian is going to be lambda psi. Let me write tau over sigma. So what is this sigma here? Sigma is a time scale that I introduce. This is an explicit notation that I want the switching function to be non-zero only for a small amount of time, for an amount of time sigma. And by non-zero, I don't mean just compact support. Compact support is a case, but it could be that it's very strong, the interaction, at some time, and then very weak at longer times. For example, a Gaussian function would be one of those. I call those things strongly supported functions. They have most of the support is in a finite region of length scale omega or time scale omega, or sigma. Right, so that sigma is just the parameter that tells you where the function is non-zero, basically. It's just notation, huh? You could have a tau no matter what. It's just to notate that there's a scale in there. All right. Then you have the integral d n psi f psi monopole tau phi tau t of tau psi x of tau psi. Now, of course, if you do a point-like detector, then you know that what you have is that f of psi is just a delta of psi. That's what point-like means. If we substitute in and we do the integral, we get that in that case, the interaction Hamiltonian that generates translation with respect to tau is equal to lambda chi tau sigma mu tau phi of t at tau 0, x at tau 0, and of course, t of tau 0, this is the t of tau 0, x of tau 0, is the trajectory of the center of mass of the detector. So you can just write here, to abbreviate, t of tau, x of tau. Agreed, everyone? Psi equals 0 is the center of mass of the detector. All right, so let's quickly compute this transition probability. So this p, let me call it p plus minus. Plus for the positive omega, so excitation probability, minus for negative omega, the excitation probability. It's equal to lambda, what time is it? All right, lambda squared d tau prime. I'm going to be a bit fast with this one. The two switchings. And then, of course, I have E mu tau G G mu tau prime E. And then I have the trace over the field of rho field field at T tau prime X tau prime phi T of tau X of tau. So this thing we computed yesterday, this thing as I wrote it is I e to the I omega tau minus tau prime. You can quickly check. And this thing here, no question, I heard my own echo and I thought it was a question, sorry about that. All right, so this thing we call W of T of tau prime, X of tau prime, T of tau, X of tau, which we abbreviate, by the way, as W of tau prime tau for now. And I want to talk with you about this object here that I call W, okay? A little bit. Anyway, so if you compute this, what you get is that this transition probability is equal to the following. And remember this formula, because on Monday, we'll start playing with this expression that we obtained here. This is lambda squared dt, d tau prime, the two switchings, e to the plus minus, so I forgot the plus minus. So I'm doing the plus minus, of course. Plus minus e to the I omega tau minus tau prime, W of t tau prime tau. Okay, so remember this expression. This is the transition probability for a detector interacting with an arbitrary state of, if you want, let me notate a rho in here, an arbitrary state of the field describing an arbitrary trajectory. Of course, this thing is frame invariant, and I recommend there's something that we will link to the supplemental material paper. Where it'd be a nice exercise if you could repeat the there's a calculation of vacuum excitation computed in the lab frame and computed in the atoms frame, the detector's frame, getting the same result. It is kind of nice. So I recommend that you do it. It's good practice. Not necessary or anything, but it's good practice. The one thing I want to discuss before I leave is a little bit about this object W in there. Is that something that you guys are familiar with from your field theory courses? Probably yes. This W has a name. Well, has many names if you want. It's a two-point correlator of the field. Well, in fact, as written there, it's kind of a pullback of a two-point correlator of the field along the trajectory of the detector. It's also called the two-point function. It's also called the two-point Wyman function. It's also called a Wyman function. So let me introduce the Wyman function, where the word function we put in quotes if you want, because it's not a function. So distribution. So the Wyman function, W of, and I'm going to notate this is for vector notation, so x prime, not to write t and x all the time. Okay, so this x with serif here means for vector. Okay, so this thing I defined as the expectation of phi at x times phi at x prime, right, on a state rho. So this is nothing but, if you can do traces, there's a lot to say because we're going to have maybe interaction theory or something. So if you have these things are trace class, super important, or at least your state is such that multiply by this is trace class, which could be, meaning like this may not be trace class, but then the whole thing may be trace class. Anyway, the trace of rho phi x phi x prime. All right, from this definition, we see already that w of x prime x, so if we swap the arguments, what do we get? If we swap the arguments, we put the prime in here, right? But then we can cycle twice with the cyclic property of the trace and get the conjugate of w. So this thing is equal to the conjugate of x, x prime. Okay? Everyone? This is just, you know, swap the primes and then start rotating things. And then you get the whole thing ordered in the opposite direction, which is the conjugate. So interesting things about the Weidman function. So what is the imaginary part of the Weidman function? Well, the imaginary part, of course, is 1 over 2i w x x prime minus w star x x prime. Okay, but that's equal to 1 over 2 trace 2i trace of rho, and then you have phi x prime minus phi x prime phi x. Agreed? I just used this property right here. All right, nice. So, but what is this object? I recognize this object. This is 1 over 2i, the expectation of the commutator of the field at x and at x prime. This thing has a name as well. In algebraic quantum field theory, I don't know how much you've seen of this, though. This has a name in algebraic quantum field theory. It's called the Pauli-Lubansky distribution. This thing is called Pauli-Lubansky. Or you can call it just the expectation of the commutator of the field in the state rho. The real part, you repeat the same thing. Oh, what's it going to be, huh? You can guess already, huh? 1 over 2 of the expectation, for the sake of time, just repeat it, but the expectation, of course, of the anti-commutator of the field. Right, if you add the commutator and the anti-commutator, you get the whole thing. Anyway. Same repetition of the same steps. Oh my. Right, you do it like, yeah, the real part is this plus its conjugate divided by 2. Then you substitute in and you get the sum instead of the difference. So you get the anti-commutator in here. This thing has a name as well. It's called the Hadamard on the state row distribution. So let's think a little bit about this. So two comments, and I will end with these two comments, but they're important comments. To begin with, if we are working with a free theory, like the easiest ones that we know, like a free scalar or free whatever theory, then we know several things. Oh, there's one thing that we know about field theories that are okay in general. Let's talk about it in general field theories that are okay. And by okay, I mean that they're relativistic, which is the kind of quantum field theories we want. We know that this thing, if x and x dot and x prime are space-like separated, what would this be? Anyone? Loud, I heard it. Zero. Indeed, microcausality. Our theory, our quantum field theory, needs to be microcausal, which means that otherwise you would be able to get information of the field at x and find that information about x prime that is space-like separated. This thing is zero in space-like separation. So you have two detectors that are space-like separated. The interaction of the detectors with the field can acquire correlations with each other through the Hadamard, because the Hadamard is non-zero, but not through the commutator. So signaling, as we will see when we talk about communication, signaling of detectors through the field is going to be governed by this, when, and therefore is going to be not possible when they're space-like separated. Okay? But you can maybe do entanglement harvesting, as I told you. You have detectors that are space-like separated, and they can get entangled, even if they don't know about each other. Even locally, those detectors know nothing about each other. They may be able to get correlated through this, depending on how many correlations there are in the state of the field, through the Hadamard, without violating any causality at all. Now, in a free theory, in a theory of the easy kind that we know about, we know that the commutator of the field is a C number, is a multiple of the identity, which is nice, because that would mean that the Pauli-Lubansky is state independent. So the terms that allow for communication are state independent in a free theory, which is kind of nice, which tells you in communication there are many aspects that are classical. This thing is classical. Being state independent is akin to saying this is actually a radiation green function if you go to classical field theory. And this thing, is if you want radiation green function, is the advanced minus the retarded. And this thing is a solution of the homogeneous Klein-Gordon equation in K-space. Anyway, the point being that this thing for a free field is state independent. No matter how quantum the state of the field is, well, this thing doesn't care. All right. This thing, on the other hand, though, this thing, on the other hand, is state dependent. And this thing cares a lot about what the state of the field is and its quantum nature and so on. There is a way of building quantum field theory. It's a tricky theory. And by that, I mean if you want to postulate, postulating quantum mechanics is easy. Postulating relativity is easy. Postulating quantum field theory was not easy. When people tried to do quantum field theory by axiomatization, which means like let's build it from taking a series of axioms and build what a field theory is, people faced problems. And it was the person who kind of, the biggest person who kickstarted this was precisely the person after which this function is named, Wightman. Wightman has something called the reconstruction theorem that basically tells you this is, if you see a two-point function, you can have endpoint function. For example, the one-point function is just the field expectation. Two-point function is the two-point correlator. Well, if you want the correlator without the convex part, the correlator, you subtract the product of the two expectations for the, what we properly call the correlator, but it's a two-point function. Endpoint function, you have n of them, n fields in here. Wightman tells you, reconstruction theorem tells you that if building the vacuum state and so on is tough. Again, you have many symmetries. You may get it from first principles, but in a general field theory, you may not even know what the vacuum is, if that exists. But you may be able to still define a quantum field theory by defining the Wightman functions of the vacuum. So if you, by definition, say, these are my Wightman functions, in particular, the Hadamard part of it. If I postulate the form of axiomatize, if you want, the form of my Wightman functions on the vacuum, that allows me to build the full quantum field theory without talking about states, without talking about the vacuum. And then you can have all the phenomenology of quantum field theory. And you can define local algebras of observables and all that you need to have in order to have a functional theory, a quantum field theory. These things are tough. There were very few people, super clever and super good people working on this. There still are. But if you want to know about this, Malamud's theorem that tells you, for example, that it's impossible to do relativistic quantum mechanics. Several assumptions are incompatible. Then people like Halvorsen. There's many people after Wightman that have worked in this. I recommend that you take a look at the field. It's called algebraic quantum field theory. It's a kind of very cool field. If you're interested in field theory, this is like trying to make it rigorous, because quantum field theory is plagued of problems, because we don't know how to do things, and sometimes we make up as we go. And they try to do it like the same way we know quantum mechanics, postulate and axiomatize that we care. The problems with these things, you keep in mind, this operator is very tough to do things with this, because a field operator, even if you restrict it, you smear it on a finite region, that field operator, is still not a bounded operator. And that's problematic, because many of the theorems in functional analysis that allows you to talk about these things, so versions of the spectral theorem and so on, that allows you to do the quantum theory that we know and love when we do quantum mechanics, you can't in quantum field theory. So how to do these things carefully is what is called, if you want, algebraic quantum field theory. Now, why am I telling you this? If the state of the field, say, is Gaussian, and maybe Aggie can tell me how much you've seen of that. If the state of the field in quantum optics often, you describe states of the field given the Wigner function, a distribution in phase space. You've seen that? Right. If the Wigner function is Gaussian, we call those things Gaussian states. Those Gaussian states can be fully specified by given the first and second moments. Because that's a Gaussian can be specified by given the first and second moments. So this is this, and the expectation of the field for a Gaussian state is all you need to fully reconstruct the whole field. So you can get all the endpoint functions, all of them, by using Wick theorem and the fact that it's Gaussian. So you express all the endpoint functions as product of the two-point functions, and you know the two-point function if the state is Gaussian. The cool point is that detectors, I did perturbative calculations, but detectors see endpoint functions. All that you see in the field when you interact locally, measurements that are allowed by the laws of physics, where are like the POVMs on the field that come from coupling particle detectors, see endpoint functions. So you can fully describe the theory. If you go axiomatic on me, and we don't talk anymore about states, and we define states as maps, rather, that take you from a field configuration to a Weidman function, then I can do all the phenomenology right away without caring about, oh, is this observable? I'm going to get a divergence. You know what I mean? Like, these things can be done. All the detector physics can be done just specifying two-point functions. And this is as much as I'm going to talk about algebraic concepts in quantum field theory, probably. Oh, no, because we're going to talk about thermality. Defining thermal states is freaking difficult. A thermal state gives us a great definition that is fantastic as long as we have finite dimensional quantum systems. When we have infinite dimensional quantum systems, we're going to suffer to define it. There were other people that helped us here, which is Kubo, Martin, Schwinger, KMS condition, and KMS states. But what it means to be thermal with a quantum field is non-trivial. So when Planck was saying, oh, we have a cavity containing light and it's thermalized and so on, so many things under the carpet. You see, when we do physics, oftentimes we solve the problems before understanding what we are doing. So to try to understand thermality in fields, in field theory, we're going to need a little bit of algebraic formulation, a little bit of math, if you want, functional analysis, but not much. Complex analysis and functional analysis, just a little bit. But I thought it would be nice to mention the connections, if you are more interested in fundamentals of quantum field theory, the connections of these objects with the physics of particle detectors. That seems very like connecting quantum optics with fundamental field theory that I like a lot. By the way, those of you who are more familiar with the usual particle physics dominated approach of quantum field theory, which is very phenomenological, the Weidman function can be written in terms of the Feynman propagator if you want as well. They are related. So those of you who are familiar with the Feynman propagator, as in like a time ordering this, instead of, you know, basically having a time ordering here, the things are related. You can write one in terms of combinations of the other with different dependencies and so on. So we are talking about the same objects. The difference here, what we're going to do is that we're going to have processes such as thermalization that involve time scales, and we're going to have finite times. And those things in the particle physics approach, the usual particle physics approach, are not considered, and they are completely overlooked. So we're going to get a little bit into that from the point of view of we are measuring fields by coupling stuff to them. And I extended myself a lot today. Sorry. Thank you for bearing with me. This is for Monday. Monday, we're going to start with the Andrew effect, the classic derivation of the Andrew effect, the first one that was given, and the problems with that. I'm going to just show you slides and wave hands. And then in the tutorial, you're going to do the calculations rigorously. And then after that, and we're going to discuss the many problems with this original derivation there were, and how we can address it with the rigorous definition of thermality for the field and particle detectors, which is the current version of the Andrew effect. If you ask Andrew what the Andrew effect is, Andrew will tell you, yeah, accelerated particle detectors click thermalize with a temperature that depends on acceleration. And we will see all that starting Monday. Thank you again. I've just talked too much.